Good. Well, I'm Rick Michaud, and I'm an evolutionary biologist at the University of Arizona. And I really am glad to be back at KITP. I was here 2 years ago and started some projects with people I never would have interacted with otherwise. And I'm going to give a brief update of those projects, I hope, at some point this morning. But it is a very special place here. And I'm here mainly because I study the evolution of multicellularity in a group of green algae, Volvox and its relatives. And I'm looking to kind of retool and get some new directions for my research in this area. I was a department head for 14 years and stepped down about a year ago. And kind of feel I was able to keep my research going, but I kind of feel I lost my edge, and so I'm looking for some new ideas. And so with that, I want you to feel free to make suggestions. I won't take offense if you think I should be doing something completely different or that I'm missing some angle on the questions that I'm trying to ask. Let me begin, as others have, just by acknowledging all the people that did the work, because I may not get there. And that doesn't work. That works, I guess. Okay. So Ray Goldstein, John Kessler, who are two physicists that I was introduced to by my student Christian Soleri here, he came to work in my lab to study the evolution of multicellularity, and he wandered over into the physics building one day because we didn't know anything about motility, and we knew that motility was really important for these algae just to maintain their position in the sun in these little ponds that they flourish in. And so, well, this developed a long collaboration which is still ongoing. Ray Goldstein has since moved to Cambridge. John has since retired. And Christian has moved down to Argentina. But this use of hydrodynamics to understand the motility of these algae is something that we're very interested in. It's something that these people led that part of the project. Then there were a group of people that helped with the modeling and the theory. Denny Rose and Yannick Viosat, both are professors in France now. And Armin Rashidi is a medical doctor, but they helped develop the mathematical models that I'll be just very briefly introducing you to. Matt Herron helped with, basically did all the phylogeny work that we've done, as well as has done some artificial selection experiments on body size in these algae and how it selects for somatic cells. I might as well just say a few words about the algae just while they're on the board here. So this is Volvox on the left with its somatic cells on the exterior. It's a spherical organism, and the somatic cells are on the exterior. And the germ cells, the gonidia they're called, I'll try and not use that word because it's a jargon word, but the reproductive cells are on the interior. And this is a juvenile colony because these germ cells are just single cells. During development, they will divide and produce a daughter colony on the inside. So these babies will then hatch out. And here we're looking at the somatic cells that are kind of on the exterior, peering in, looking at the babies that are about ready to hatch. And so we did, so Matt, and the nice thing about this group of algae is that there is kind of a progressive, there are intermediate species that we like to think of as being similar to the intermediate types that might have evolved during the evolution of multicellularity. At least it helps us think about it in that way. And these intermediate species, some of them have somatic cells but don't have specialized germ cells, and Matt did some selection experiments on body size in those species, and I'll hope to be telling you about that.
So these are different scales.
Yeah, I'm going to be showing definitely different scales, yeah. Yeah, this is
way magnified.
This is way magnified, and that isn't. I'll have some slides with some scale bars.
In detail about what you just said, so I'll
yeah, I will be, yeah. Yeah, and this is Aurora Nedelcu about 14 years ago. Actually, yeah, right when I started being department head, I started doing this work. And Aurora helped me, she was a postdoc at the time, helped me set up the lab. I kind of retooled from bacteria into studying algae, and she was, and she's now a professor in Canada at the University of New Brunswick. And then Pierre Durand was here during the last workshop. A few of you were here at KITP. He organized the symposium. He's a professor in South Africa, and he did a lot of the genomics work as well as a lot of the work involving programmed cell death that I may or may not get to. And he also is leading, the thing I will try to get to is this protein-protein interaction network that we've used the genome of these three species of algae that I'll be telling you about. He spearheaded that project, and it started here at KITP when we met this computer scientist that was developing this engine that predict protein interaction. So I know many of you are protein biologists, so I'm hoping to get your take on all that. And then there's a group of people doing the genomics work, mainly Brad Olson, who was also here 2 years ago, and he's an assistant professor in Kansas, and he and Eric Hanshin are kind of spearheading. Eric's a graduate student in my lab, and they've teamed up to kind of spearhead the genomics work on these intermediate species, and I'll be telling you about gonium is the first paper that's going to, we hope, will be coming out. It's currently under review. And then Patrick is kind of the lab leader in my lab, runs the lab, and he's a kind of specialist, senior scientist working on Chlamydomonas and Volvox and so on. And then this is a current graduate student, Zach, who is doing some transformation experiments. I'll be telling you about the genes underlying the somatic differentiation. And it's a very simple genetic system that causes soma and germ, very simple. And there's this gene called RegA, which you'll be hearing a lot about. And basically, we've been working on the evolutionary history of this RegA gene and trying to ask what it's doing in species that don't have germ and soma, if it's there. And he's found out that it's there. And so his PhD thesis will be about doing transformation experiments to move the RegA gene around to try and understand if the RegA gene is changing functionally or if it's the network that it's embedded in that's changing and affects its expression. And again, I hope to be getting to some of that. And then finally, Deborah is a postdoc now. Hopefully she'll be here in a couple of weeks for a few days. She's working on the cell cycle of Chlamydomonas and how it changes as what are thought to be Chlamydomonas-like cells. So these cells in Volvox are thought to be Chlamydomonas-like. Of course, Chlamydomonas doesn't specialize in germ and soma, it's just a single cell. But it goes through similar stages where it's reproductive or where it's flagellated and just has its two flagella and moves about in its environment, and then it loses its flagella and it uses the mitotic spindles and so on to undergo cell division. And so in Volvox, those two functions that are separated temporally in clammy are separated spatially in Volvox by just turning off the flagella genes, and or basically that's kind of a crude characterization of it, but and upregulating the reproductive gene. But and again, I'll talk more about that. And Deborah's very interested in how that cell cycle changes when it goes from a single cell to a multicellular organism, and she'll be visiting here. And then finally, Dinah will also be here for 3 weeks, and she's working on the role of environmental stress in the evolution of these colonial forms. So those are the people. And these are the funding sources. Very appreciative of those groups for continuing to support us. Okay, so just as background, the main kind of landmarks in the diversity of life are these levels in the so-called hierarchy of life. And genes are organized in chromosomes, and chromosomes compose genomes, genomes in simple bacteria-like cells. Simple bacteria-like cells form complex eukaryotic-like cells, eukaryotic cells. And then there's a transition to multicellular organisms, and these multicellular organisms can be based on eukaryotic cells as it's drawn here, but also can be based on bacteria-like cells as in the lineage Myxococcus. And then under some conditions, organisms evolve into groups of organisms that are social especially in the eusocial insects. And so this is, each level in the hierarchy is a group of, is a nested level of organization made up of groups of the lower level entities. So this is what I mean by the hierarchy of life. And it didn't always exist, right? Life began very simple. And so it's something that compels us to explain this hierarchy as evolutionary biologists. So that's the kind of the challenge that we have facing us, is how to explain the origin and evolution of the hierarchy of life. And each level has these basic Darwinian properties of variation, reproduction, and heritability. But we want to understand is how these Darwinian properties emerge at a new level where they didn't initially exist, where they only existed at the lower level. And so how, as it were, cells relinquish their claim to fitness and in favor of the multicellular organism that they're now a part of. Cells, as we know, are fierce individuals and for billions of years have undergone evolution just as cells as organisms. But when they take up residence in a group, and that group then evolves into a multicellular organism, they relinquish some of these properties of having fitness. And they specialize in components of fitness that are now properties of the group. And so it's that transition that I'm trying to understand. I'm seeing a lot of puzzled looks, though. Yeah.
I don't understand what that means. You
what?
I don't understand what relinquishing fitness means in the context that you just said.
So I'm going to be talking a lot about that, and so I hope to make that clear. But most of our cells in our body are evolutionary dead ends, right? And so the somatic cells are what are called reproductive altruists. Basically, they have given up the claim of reproduction in an evolutionary sense, in favor of building complex bodies that help pass on the information that's in the germ cells. So in a sense, they've relinquished an important component of evolutionary fitness. That is the ability to make descendants. Yeah, and help the body, the organism, multicellular organism. Pass on its gene. So it's more difficult to understand in these simple groups that form initially. And I hope to show you some pictures. Why cells would ever do that? I mean, in our well-organized bodies, it's kind of maybe apparent, but not so clear in these simple groups how it gets started. So this is just saying the same thing, but I'll be that life is a nested hierarchy. But I'll be arguing that there's kind of a cycle of things come together and cooperate to do things that they can't do alone, and that's the kind of the engine of this group formation process that underlies this hierarchy. There can be conflicts arise. And that these conflicts have to be mediated. And so this is kind of the theme or the storyline that I'll be trying to explore during the talk. Okay, well, so I've just said then, the challenge is to understand how groups of reproducing individuals become reproducing individuals themselves. Right? So we're reproducing individuals, but we're groups of cells, and cells were once reproducing individuals, and how during evolution do, and so we had to start out as groups of cells at some point, simple groups of cells, and so how do those groups then acquire their own individuality when they're initially just made up of cells which are starting out as individuals? So how do groups become individuals? Another way of saying that. So let's just refresh our thinking on what are Darwin's properties. Darwin observed that if entities undergo a struggle to survive and reproduce, that there's variation in the ability to undertake the struggle, and that offspring tend to resemble parents, and to the extent that all these things are true, then the population will self-organize, and those variants that are more able to undertake the struggle, they'll come to predominate in the population. The ones with traits that detract from that will tend to decrease in frequency in the population. And different authors have viewed this differently and tried to summarize Darwin's properties differently. Lewontin summarized it as variation, fitness differences, and heritability. Maynard Smith summarized it as the ability to multiply and variation and heredity. And one can summarize the Darwinian, all these things, by just saying there has to be heritable variation and fitness at a level of organization for it to self-organize and adapt to its environment. And so we're trying to explain how those properties arise in groups where they didn't first exist, where they existed at the lower level initially. So how can Darwinian properties arise in entities that do not possess them? So the theory of population genetics, it concerns the frequencies and probabilities of genes, and how do we count them? How do we calculate them? We have to count individuals to do that, and so it's not obvious how we can use the theory of population genetics to explain the origin of individuals, which are kind of presupposed in the theory. But there is a way through this in something called multi-level selection theory. And I'm just going to introduce you to this theory. I'm not going to actually go through it, but one can take Darwin's properties and observe that they exist at different levels of organization. Here we're talking about organisms and groups, and we're indexing organisms and we're indexing the groups, and then we have the total population, the total ensemble of groups. And one can then calculate in each organism, say if it's a diploid, the number of genes it has at a given locus. And if there's some subpopulation or group S, one has the same can do the same thing there and then get the total population. And one can then calculate the overall change in gene frequency as involving the change in gene frequency that might occur within an individual, well, barring mutation and kind of selfish selection or elements within the organism, that might be zero. But within the subpopulation, there might be a change in gene frequency, but then different groups might contribute more or less propagules to the total population, and that would be the total change in gene frequency. So this is called multi-level selection theory. And I'm not going to go into any of the details about it, but we've spent a number of years applying this to the evolution of multicellularity. And I'll talk about that in a minute. So the kinds of questions that we're trying to answer, first of all, is why does cellular selection between competing cell lineages and organism, not disrupt selection at the level of the group, the cell group, or the organism? Does that make sense as a question? So, for example, cancer lineages within our bodies, there can be selection for more and more virulent kinds of cancer, and that would normally disrupt the organism. It doesn't always occur. There are maybe adaptations that the organism has that prevent that from occurring most of the time. And what are those adaptations? can selection at the level of the group lead to adaptations that reduce the competition? I just said that. And so I'll be arguing that the very distinction between germ and soma is a kind of helps mediate the conflict by putting, by having somatic cells that don't have the privilege of going into the germ line. They have really no choice, as it were, other than to cooperate if they're going to pass on their genes, which are present in the germ cells also, because of course they're all part of a clonal lineage. And so this very distinction itself between germ and soma, reproductive cells and somatic cells, is thought to be a kind of mediator of conflict, help ensure cooperation among the group of cells that are in the multicellular organism. A single cell, passing the cell lineage through a single cell bottleneck is thought to be help in reducing conflict, because then it makes all the cells genetically clonally related. And if they're clonally related, then they're they have the same interests. They're all in the same boat. And programmed cell death is another, can be viewed as another way of mediating conflict that can exist among cells. So everyone's awful quiet, so I'm just wondering if I'm getting off and if it's sounding too abstract, or it's kind of obvious, or everyone's comfortable with the way I'm setting up these questions.
I think it's very clear, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to talk down, or if I'm saying things that are obvious. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so how can our Darwinian properties arise in entities that do not possess them? Can we use a theory of population genetics to explain the origin of individuals, because it presupposes this origin? Well, I've already suggested how we might be able to do this. How do groups of individuals
become? Actually, do you have one question here? So yeah. Are these organisms sexual, or when in all of this are they mixing?
Right. So in the lineage that we'll be kind of digging into here, this algae lineage, they are facultatively sexual. And these multicellular forms, these groups of cells, form only in the asexual stage. And sex is really not a way of reproduction in these algae. It's a way of producing a spore, which is a specialized, and we'll talk about that. Yeah. So the approaches that we're using is these mathematical models of multi-level selection I've talked about, these vulvocene green algae, which we'll be spending a lot of time, I'll introduce you to them in a minute. And we've also been doing some philosophy. You can kind of imagine that this search for individuals and how individuals arise kind of might perk the interest of philosophers, and indeed it has. And there's a really active group of philosophers that are contributing to this area. So let me just briefly introduce you to the algae. We collect them around Arizona in these temporary ponds that arise, and this is Deborah and Aurora out on the edge of the pond just collecting algae. And we find Chlamydomonas, single-celled critters here, shown here with this two flagella, and then we also find these more interesting intermediate forms that I'll be introducing you to. This is like Basiclamis or Tetrabenus, simple four-celled organism. There was a paper in PLOS Biology, I think it was a year or two ago, arguing that this is the simplest integrated multicellular organism. Don't know if that's true, but it's certainly one of the simplest multicellular organisms, and it's integrated in the sense that the eye spots and the flagella are oriented in ways that it can swim as a group of four cells.
How many cells are there in this multicellular?
Four here.
Yeah.
How many cells?
How many, yeah.
Four.
Oh, four, just
yeah.
Four.
Yeah, just four here. Yeah, just eight here, and this is gonium, and you can see its flagella are out here. Gonium is like a curved sheet. And this is Pandorina, 16 cells. This is Euterina, 32 cells. And you can see it's getting a little bit more complex. So here, it's just basically four cells stuck together. Here, it's a sheet organization. Then we start getting spheres. This is like a compact sphere of cells. There's no like, there's no really well-defined interior versus exterior. Here, we're getting the evolution of what's called the extracellular matrix, this kind of space-filling material that And these cells are kind of distributed on the outside of this extracellular matrix, and there's a colony boundary. Here there's no colony boundary, really. Here there's no colony boundary. Here we start seeing a colony boundary, a boundary evolving around the whole colony.
Yeah? The shape is not symmetric when it's 16 words.
The shape is not symmetric where?
When there are 16 cells.
When there are 16 cells, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Is there any reason for that?
Well, I'm sure there are, but I don't. So this whole issue of spherical organization and why it becomes spherical is something of great interest to us, and we don't really have an experimental program that is addressing that. I think in these cases there is of course an issue about just getting the problem with being in a group. I mean, groups are great, but the big problem is that you're competing with your neighbors for access to nutrients, and you're excreting waste products in each other's face. And so, you prefer not to be in the interior of the group, in terms of getting the maximum diffusion of resources and waste products out. So I'm sure that that's one of the factors that affects the morphology, but.
The shape of the colony looks like this for all.
Well, in all environments, you mean? You're asking if I change the environment, does the shape change?
Or just even in one environment, one system, the other one does the shape.
So these are different species, right? So these are different species with different organizations. But I don't know how the shape depends upon the environment. Yeah, I don't think very little is known about that.
Mm-hmm. The individuals within a species always have the same shape, or do they
have diversity? Yeah, they always, at least, you know, in the environments that we grow them in, or we collect them from the ponds, they always look the same. Yeah. And
so the question about shape, I don't feel I understand the shape of the 16.
I don't feel I do either. Pardon me?
Are they flattened? What exactly are we looking at?
I'm not sure what this is actually. I grabbed this slide from one of Deborah's presentations, and I think it's Pandorina, and if it is, then it would just be a slice through it. Okay. And
these are possibly fixed or some other perturbed in some way.
But it could just be a 16-cell gonium. It might just be that, actually. It might be this creature with 16 cells. I think, so gonium, that's probably what it is. So gonium you can find is 8 or 16 cells. And then it's a curved sheet. And so I guess that that's what I'm showing you here. And I apologize for not really or knowing for sure.
When you say curved sheet, you mean there's many of them next to each other and there's little curves, or there's a whole?
No, the whole sheet of cells is curved.
Okay, so it's like a small curve around the 8 or 16 cells.
It's like a flat sheet. It's curved. Yeah.
Are all Are all of these facultatively sexual?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And but they have different kinds of sex. They have Chlamydomonas is isogamous, and so is gonium. So its gametes are equal-sized kind of mating types. But then in Volvox, which is the next click here, so these are species of Volvox which are different from here in that they're larger. They have thousands of cells, and they have cell differentiation. So the big thing about Volvox is that it has reproductively specialized cells which don't have a flagella at all, and then permanently flagellated somatic cells which don't ever divide. And so, what was the question you had asked?
Yeah, I was just asking about the different kinds of sexual reproduction.
Right. And so they have anisogamous sex. So they make sperms and eggs. And in some species, it's dioecious, and some species is monoecious. And they have a complete, all the diversity of sexual forms exist in this lineage. And so now that we kind of have at least a sampling of the scale of morphological complexity here in front of us, let's just keep track of what are the elements of that complexity. So there's increasing body size. There's this spatial organization getting more and more pronounced, in which there's an interior and a surface, and the somatic cells end up taking residence on the surface, the germ cells kind of on the inside, and usually in the anterior position of it. So they're swimming in one direction. The germ cells are usually in the bottom, and so just sheer cell number is one. This kind of morphological structural complexity is another, and the division of labor is the other main part of this increase in complexity, in which there's two cell types. Now, it's interesting to me, I mean, so, you know, plants, higher plants and animals are elsewhere in the tree of life. These things have been evolving for about 200 million years, and they got these forms. I'll show you the phylogeny in a moment. Within about 30 million years, they had all these forms, and they've been pretty static since. And so it appears that they haven't gone anywhere other than this. And I think that's interesting, is why haven't they, you know, the road to more complex multicellular forms seems to be elsewhere. And I think, I'll just say what I think the reason is that the somatic cell that they evolved is a non-replicative somatic cell. So unlike the somatic cells in our body, which can replicate, the somatic cells in these volvox are starved cells. So they're just kept small. And this RegA gene that I'll be telling you about downregulates the chloroplast biogenesis. Not having chloroplast, they can't really grow in the sun. Not being able to grow, they can't divide. And so the somatic lineage is basically a starved cell lineage. And so it, and all the somatic cells you're ever going to have are formed when you're inside your mother, you know, basically. Yeah. There's no post-embryonic cell division. So the somatic line is a good thing. If it evolves, it makes the cells cooperate and in favor of passing on, you know, offspring through the germline. But if it's non-replicative, it can't really make any other interesting forms. You know, once those 2,000 somatic cells are made, they're just there. They don't ever replicate. Say it again.
Can every one of them reproduce? So they're just stick together by some.
So which picture here?
You say the one right.
Here.
Right. Right bottom.
Here.
Yeah. You say they evolve ECM.
Yeah.
Does that mean they just stick together by some gel-like thing?
Right. So ECM is not a cell. It's like a gelatinous. Compound, it's rich in glycoproteins, and the we'll see when we look at the genomes of so we have the genomes of Volvox carteri, which is here, and we have the genomes for clammy, and we're just in the process of publishing the genome for gonia, and if we look at basically the remarkable thing when you look at these genomes is how identical they are. And there's just a few gene families that have evolved. And one of them is the gene family giving rise to these ECM proteins, these extracellular matrix proteins. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Do they still divide based on size criteria? For example, when cell number reach some threshold, then the whole?
No, all the cells, so if we go back to like just that picture, we had a Volvox on the board. In other words, these cells here are going to, I should tell you a key thing. So they don't do, one thing in this whole lineage, the ancestral kind of cell division is what's called palindromy. So they, instead of growing and dividing, like in binary fission, they grow, 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 and then divide, 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 And they usually organize those divisions at night when the sun's not out. And so each of these cells here, so in a species that doesn't have any differentiation among its cells, except maybe the orientation of its flagella or its eye spots, but it doesn't have any division of labor and reproduction soma, such as this species, 32 cells. Each of these cells is going to grow really big inside here and then divide enough times to make 32 cells here, and then it's going to hatch out. So it's not going to ever divide again. I mean, there's no that's what I mean by no post-embryonic growth. Once these little embryos hatch out, there's no more cell division. So it's like there's no more cell division at that point. All the cells divisions occurs within the parental colony. Is that making sense? I'm going to show a picture of that.
Maybe asking too much, but since it's so recent, have they evolved their own sort of novel way of cell differentiation at the molecular level, and is it entirely different and somehow limited in terms of how much cell differentiation can happen? Or you probably don't have any idea.
About why there's not a third cell type, or what
would be the third? How they differentiate cells at the molecular level.
Well, in Volbox-Carteri, we know that in the fifth cell division. So there's to produce 2,000 cells, maybe there's 16 or 18 cell divisions, and in the fifth one, there's an asymmetric division. And the large cell then becomes a germ, a gonidia, a germ cell. And the small cells just stay small. And they express this RegA gene, which downregulates the chloroplast biogenesis, which keeps them small. And so being small, they never divide. And they just keep their flagella. Because what clammy does, when it goes through its life cycle, it grows. It has its flagella, it grows and grows, maybe fourfold, and then it absorbs its flagella and it divides really quickly into producing, say, 16 daughter cells. And I have some pictures of that later on, and I try to jump to them now, I think I make a mess of things.
So I'm gonna say this next slide, because I think you've done a really good job of introducing us.
Uh-huh.
You're almost like halfway through your time.
And I'm almost halfway through, is that right? Yeah, okay. Okay, right. So, so I was gonna talk about levels of selection, and I don't think I will then talk about it. So I'm gonna have to skip around here. Let me find out where I wanna be then.
I'm not saying you should skip around, I just wanna make sure that you know where you are.
Yeah.
Because you've said lots of interesting things you're gonna talk
about. So I was going to give kind of a little overview of multi-level selection, which I don't think I'll do now, and how it's useful to ask these questions. I really have introduced a lot about the group here. Let me just finish up about the sex. So this is the life cycle of clammy, and this is the life cycle of Volvox, and this is the sexual stage is up here, and the asexual stage is down here. Simply to say that this is a complex story. So let's not go there, actually, yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about now these 12 steps here. So a famous developmental geneticist, David Kirk, his kind of lifetime of work is summarized in our understanding of, to get from an organism like Chlamydomonas to an organism like Volvox, what has to change. And these are his so-called 12 steps here. So these are developmental traits that evolved in the Volvocene algae. And I'm going to go through them quickly, because what we first did was map these traits on a phylogeny and see in what order they came. But this is developmentally the order they seem to occur: incomplete cytokinesis, partial embryo inversion like in gonium to get that curved sheet, then there's full embryo inversion in Volvox, There's rotation of the basal bodies, which then there's an organismal polarity which is set up, transformation of the cell wall into the extracellular matrix, increased volume of the extracellular matrix, genetic modulation of cell numbers. So that's important. So in chlamydomonas, you give it a good environment, it'll grow really big, and maybe you put it in a bad environment, it just might grow enough to divide once. You put it in a really good environment, it'll grow enough maybe to divide four times and produce 16 cells. So that doesn't happen in organisms with, quote, genetic regulation of cell number. There's a stereotypical kind of number of cells in the colony that's produced. Partial germ soma, so what that means is that there's just, there's somatic cells, but then there's these general purpose, non-specialized other cells that do both soma. They have both the flagella as well as they reproduce. Then there's complete germ soma division of labor. There's asymmetric division that I talked about just briefly already. And then there's anosogamy and oogamy. So these are some of the things that change during this march towards multicellularity in this lineage. And here they are plotted and kind of organized differently, but I'm going to jump through it. Okay, so the first thing we did is we did was to do a phylogeny of this group. And then, and so here you see the major multicellular groups here, the Volvocaceae, the Goniaceae, and the Tetrabenaceae. And the Tetrabenaceae, they're just like four cells. And the goniums are 16 up to 32. Some of these can get up to 64. And then this is the Volvocaceae, contains all the Volvox species, as well as Uterina, 32 cells, 64 cells, and so on. And so we took these 12 steps, or Matt Heron took these 12 steps and mapped them on the phylogeny. Here I just want to make some points that I've already made about the kind of a lot of stasis, the major origin of these groups back here between maybe 230 and 200 million years ago and so on.
So the genera, they've just been sort of grouped according to number of cells traditionally. So in blue clade, there's obviously.
It's a very mixed clade, this one here. But yeah, initially there were just morphological groupings of these things. Yeah.
So if you had 16 cells, you were in uterine or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. But
some things are Volvox, however.
Yeah. Volvox is paraphyletic. It's not a monophyletic group within the lineage.
And genome sequences for these?
Yeah, so we have genome sequences for three of the species. So Carteri, Chlamydomonas, and then Brad Olson has, with Eric, has done gonium. Yeah. And
the timing is from a molecular clock data, or where is that from?
Yeah, so it's there are some outgroups, and I forget how it's done, to be honest. Yeah. Yeah. And okay. Oh, wait. So how do we get back here? Yeah. So then these are the 12 steps. Okay. So then we took these 12 steps and then mapped them on the phylogeny. So what you see here is, and the black boxes are the losses of the characters, and the white boxes are the gains of the characters. And well, you can kind of see that the tempo and mode of this is very different than a progressive march along this ontogenetic kind of path, so that you know, the development, the ontogeny is not recapitulated in the phylogeny by any means. And if you ask about division of labor, which has been something we've been very interested in, sterile somatic cells have evolved at least three times in this phylogeny, and have been lost twice. And reproductive cells, specialized reproductive cells, have evolved three times in the phylogeny, or that's what we predict by this reconstruction, and have been lost once. The key innovation, if you go back to this very first node here, is the extracellular matrix, transformation of a cell wall into an extracellular matrix, as well as a genetic control of cell number. So This is what, we interpret this as kind of a cooperation, conflict mediation kind of story. And it's just a story, but the extracellular matrix is a way to share things. It's kind of a commons in the cell, or we think it is. We actually haven't even tested that. So that's something we would like to do, is see resources move, somehow label things in the extracellular matrix and see them move and shared and so on. But and then this genetic control of cell number is also predicted to have evolved initially to kind of set off the radiation. And anyway, as I just said, it's a cycle of cooperation, conflict, and conflict mediation.
And those are based on phenotypic characterization?
Are they based on phenotypic characterization? So we're taking those 12 steps.
Yeah, okay. It's the 12 steps, okay.
So that is kind of weird. What is the ECM?
So it's hydroxyproline glycoproteins, yeah. And it has about the density of water. It's not very different from water. It's a modification of the cell wall. So we'll show you some diagrams of that.
The individual cells look like they're held in space in very even intervals.
Surface, how is that accomplished?
Yeah.
Yeah, is there some kind of skeleton there? I don't know. Mm-hmm. So let me, so I had my skip slide. I had a slide positioned a little bit farther on to check the time. and so there's about a half hour. So let me think here. I think what I want to jump to is the evolution of germ soma, a division of labor. And so the title of this slide is Altruism and Cheating in Volvox. So how does that occur? So this is the life cycle of Chlamydomonas here in a cartoon form, a single cell. So Chlamydomonas is thought to be similar to the, Chlamydomonas is a modern organism, of course, but it's thought to be similar to the unicellular ancestor of the whole clade. The cells that make up Volvox are basically Chlamydomonas-like cells. It's got its two flagella. It grows, then it loses its flagella, needs the microtubules and so on, to form spindles, and then it divides a certain number of times depending on how big it's gotten. So it's basically in space, in time, it has its division of labor. It's motile, and then it's reproductive, divided in time. And now in Volvox, shown down here in the bottom, there's a gene which is a makes a transcription factor of chloroplast of biogenesis. It has its only domain is a DNA binding sand domain, which also exists in other, like in Arabidopsis and other groups. And when this is how Volvox normally looks. So the RegA gene is being expressed in all these small cells. And so they're kept small, they're kept like Chlamydomonas, and they just keep their flagella. And being kept small, they're permanently flagellated, and they just keep the colony motile, while these other cells can reproduce, the germ cells. And when you mutate it, this just says what I just said, that the RegA keeps the somatic cells small by starving them. And then when you mutate it, you end up seen that the somatic cells de-differentiate and start growing. And like and then you end up producing this whole cancerous mass where everyone's trying to reproduce. And so a lot of fecundity, but no ability to swim. And so these things sink to the bottom. So this is characterizing the Reg-A phenotype. Reg for regenerator. Yeah. Yep.
I'm just trying to just think about chloroplast. Does that mean that they decrease chloroplast biogenesis and that's why they starve? And that, is that the connection between the function of this gene and the phenotypes that you see?
Yeah. So it the somatic cells are kept somatic by the expression of Reg-A, which suppresses the chloroplast biogenesis, which doesn't allow the cells to grow. And so this is work that's been worked out by David Kirk and his students over a long period of time. Pardon me?
Does this anthropomorphic language here help us understand anything?
By calling them
altruistic gene cheating?
Well, I mean, it helps us certainly understand that the cells are giving up reproduction.
They give up reproduction. They survive in the long term. That's the only thing that matters.
Pardon me?
They survive in the long term. Otherwise, they die.
Well, but they're not passing on their genes to the next generation.
Okay. That's too much philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, this doesn't occur, and so you might think, okay, well, it's just kin selection, but you don't have this division of labor in the smaller colonies. Yeah. There's not just a single gene, so there's a whole gene family that exists, which is also upregulated, it appears, in somatic cells. At least there's at least one paper that shows that these other members of the gene family are also expressed, and the DNDS ratios seem to suggest that also. So there's this kind of Reg-A gene family, and we've been trying to understand the history of this gene family and how it originated during the diversification of the lineage. And so we've done a lot of work on that. And I think I'm going to not talk about that right now. My choices in the remaining half hour is to, I could talk about the history of the Reg-A gene family. I could also talk about the changing role of cell division during the evolution of multicellularity. And I could talk about how reproduction originates at the group level out of the cell cycle. So that's something we've been very interested in, is how the cell cycle gets modified to allow the group to reproduce itself. Or I could talk about the gonium genome.
It would be nice to know how those genes work, because, you know, if you want to know whether you could ever go back, whether a cheetah could evolve, it depends on what the gene is doing and how would you turn it up again. If you want to think about how could that system have evolved in the first place, you want to know what's the selection on the gene that starts the differentiation process, and then if you know what it does, you know, you can figure out whether a cheetah could ever evolve that would go back to the old system again.
Well, I mean, this mutation in the Reg-A goes back to the old system. In other words, that colony that I was showing you is basically a non-differentiated colony where everyone is reproducing. And it basically has no fitness at that point because it's just no one's keeping the colony motile, you know, afloat in the sun. And so, So I think it's really just that simple. It's just a crude switch in a gene, a single gene.
I just think, since this is evolutionary cell biology, I'm wondering if you could, well, for, I guess first off, I'm wondering how many more of these things could you collect? Could you break up the text, the phylogeny enough to really pin down when and where those genes were duplicated, and if they diverged functionally after they were duplicated, and mm-hmm. you know, subfunctionalized, et cetera, you know, when, where, and how that happened? I mean, is this a nice system where you might really be able to dissect it on that level?
Well, that's what I mean by the evolutionary history of RegA. Yeah. So I mean, we have done that, and we have several papers, you know, tracing out when the duplication occurred, and it occurred before the evolution of SOMA. So the problem we're faced with now is that the duplication can be traced back to species in which there is no SOMA. So we know that what's changed is the the genotype phenotype map, not really the gene. So RegA is not predicted. So we found it basically, in all the species that go back to this node. You know, we're using PCR and the genomes from gonium, and we've found the RegA gene in enough species for us to feel confident that it originated back at this node here.
That's
a duplication.
As
a duplication of a gene which exists in Chlamydomonas. And so in Chlamydomonas, and we figured out what this gene is doing in Chlamydomonas. In Chlamydomonas, it's basically turning off reproduction in Chlamydomonas. So in other words, Chlamydomonas, like any organism, when it's stressed, it has to not, you know, it doesn't make sense to try to reproduce. So this gene in Chlamydomonas is turned on when you grow Chlamy in the dark. And so it's a duplication of that gene. I think we know some of that. Yeah.
So the mutation of this gene would lead to the uncontrollable growth of somatic cells in several of the species, yeah?
That's right.
Or just
one? No, in several of them, yeah, but some of them don't have SOMA. So in other words, we found the gene in species that don't have SOMA. And so like what I was telling you is what we're planning to do now is transform the gene around to see if it it creates SOMA or not. You know, if say a gene from a species that's not having SOMA can create SOMA in a Volvox mutant, then we know that the gene hasn't evolved, but something about the network has evolved that it exists in. So that's what we're trying to do right now, or the student is doing. Does that make sense, or is that interesting? Or are you?
What is the variation in this transcription factor in terms of like sequence variation?
You mean when we find this gene, how much variation is there?
In different, those ones which have some.
Well, there's basically 100 amino acids which kind of define this this ability to, which is diagnostic, 100 amino acids. And you're asking how much variation?
Variation, yeah, I'm asking, what is the variation between those species with ECM, yeah, basically those which can, where mutation of the gene can lead to formation of this four-code SOMA, the division control, the somatic cell control of the divide.
Maybe another way of asking it, is it doing the same, finding the same, I mean, does it have the same effect as the gene duplicated from, except it's just controlled when it's regulated? I mean, exactly the same effect, or does it diverge in how it's binding?
I don't think we know. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we know that. I don't think we're at that level.
Do you know at all what controls this regulation? When reg A is expressed?
Yeah, we think it's cell size. In other words, so it's, the clue is this asymmetric division. There's another gene called GLIS, which is a chaperone protein, which causes the asymmetric division, which, and in small cells, we think it's something about the cell size, but that's all we know. I mean, that's the only hypothesis we have going there. Mm-hmm. So let's see what nugget we can move on to. Any other questions that might help me orient where I'm going to go next? So I think I'm going to talk about this. Let's talk about the gonium genome a little bit. So this is gonium, and so this is a picture that we took. This is an eight-celled colony, and when it reproduces, each cell here grows enough to divide into an eight-celled daughter colony here. And so then you see each of those eight daughter colonies and eventually separating. And so we chose this as the first intermediate species to sequence, or Brad Olson did the work on this. And the surprising thing to us is that gonium is more like Volvox than it is like clammy. We were expecting the opposite. So it's just eight cells, you know, Volvox is like thousands of cells. But the only thing the gonium genome is missing is the cell division, the radiation of this RegA cluster for cell differentiation, and it's missing all these extracellular matrix proteins, this gene family involving the extracellular matrix. It has this this cyclin radiation here of cyclin genes, and you need to see here that this is not my work. It's the work of Brad Olson and Eric, who's a student in my lab, and some other investigators. But and I have to actually read this because I don't I'm not expert in this thing. So this is the kind of the pathway of cell cycle regulation.
So you said there was a radiation of cyclin. What are we comparing that to? What are we comparing that C panel to? What is B?
B is the CD, the CDKs.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so like most eukaryotes, the clammy cell cycle, it's regulated by homologs of the retinoblastoma cell cycle regulatory pathway, in which cyclin-dependent kinases, which are, this is their gene family, bind cyclin D1 proteins, that's this family, okay, to phosphorylate and regulate retinoblastoma, which is this RB, which is shown here for gonium, clammy, and the Volvox. And then it binds with these transcription factors, which affect the binding of retinoblastoma to chromatin, and then the cell division can proceed. So that gene family, which exists in Volvox, is also existing in this very simple eight-cell colony. So we were really surprised by that. It makes sense from the kind of the modeling perspective, which I haven't really touched here, but the very first problem you have to solve is to modify the cell cycle so that it can reproduce the whole group, not just the cells. And so this fits in nicely with that. And then if you do, an experiment, so what Brad did is he did an experiment where he, there's a retinoblastoma mutant of clammy, which is very small cell size. So what you're looking at here on the x-axis is either the size of the colony or the size of the cell. If we're talking about single cells, we're looking at the size of the cell. If we're looking at the colonies, we're talking about the size of the colony in cubic microns. And then here is the number observed. So this is the clammy mutant. And then he transformed it with the retinoblastoma gene from gonium. And then he gets then these colonies forming. So we think that this was causative in the formation of groups, the mutation in this pathway.
It doesn't have anything that looks like RP.
No, it does, but it's just it does have an RB. It's called the MAT gene here, but it's an orthologous to the RB gene. There's different nomenclature, but it has that. I mean, that's what we saw in the previous slide. But it's changed. So there's the linker region is different. So if you go back here at the RB gene, there's this linker region which has been modified that's not present in Chlamydomonas. But again, it's not my work and it's not something that I understand deeply, but it is the one key discovery that came out of the gonium genome is that gonium is more like Volvox. So there was something very early on that evolved, I think, having to do with the cell cycle that set in place this radiation of multicellular forms.
Because there are differences in terms of the, what's the different ecology, say, between gonium and Chlamydomonas and Volvox?
Yeah. So they're found in the same ponds, often coexisting at different places. So gonium, it's a good swimmer. It's not a good swimmer like compared to fish or something, but it's a good swimmer in terms of algae. It can go at night. It can go down to the bottom of the pond and come up during the day, whereas Chlamydomonas can't go those long distances. So it's kind of thought that they are subdividing this habitat in different ways because you can find them coexisting.
Is there a difference in predation?
Yeah. So there's been experiments by Matt Heron and forgetting the guy's name, the guy that did all the experiments in yeast. They selected on settling rate in yeast and evolved multicellular. Yeah, Will Radcliffe. Yeah. Matt and Will have done the same experiments with Chlamydomonas, and they get the evolution of multicellular Chlamydomonas. Yeah, that just came out this past year. Is that what you asked?
I was wondering about predation, whether there's
predation. Yeah.
Even
yeah, and so people have done the same thing with predators, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought there was any sort of point to the four.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty big. I mean, you can almost see them with the naked eye. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's thought that predation is one of the factors, but they get too big for predation almost. You know, it's not the only thing driving the big body size. It's because they get too big. They escape the predation. There's a graph in many textbooks and about this, but they're almost getting, they're getting beyond that cutoff.
Which is the scheme of the RB gene, F or G?
G, yeah.
So the Gregorian lost some binding domain. What's the color domain in the gene scheme?
Yeah, I need to check my notes on that. Um, I can't, I have to get that afterwards. I don't have the text here to.
Or phonetically, when you say the change in cell cycle, does that mean some stage in cell cycle can longer in gonium or occurring or gonium? Or it change phonetically in what way?
I'm not understanding the question. Just
say, okay, you do the experiment, and people do the experiment to see when you switch different versions of these cell cycle genes, and then they see different changes in average colony size. And right. So in the description of the cell cycle, which aspect has been changed?
Just the RB gene itself.
Yeah, gene changes. I guess I'm asking, do you know what phenotypes of cell cycle change, for example, some relative order of some phosphorylation.
No, we don't know that yet. Yeah, I don't think he knows that. Yeah.
Do you think you can turn gonium into Volvox? I mean, is it simple enough that you could possibly just engineer it?
Well, we did artificial selection experiments trying to do that, and so. So that was one of the things I skipped over. So or Matt Heron did, I should say. So so this is Pleiadrina astarii. So it's a 64-celled colony, and it has partial germ soma division of labor. So it has these somatic cells at the anterior portion of the colony, and these other cells are just like chlamydomonas. They have the flagella for a while, and then they lose it and they do reproduction. But these somatic cells here, these small cells, don't do any reproduction. And so there's a reason why when cells get big, when colonies get big, there's an increasing trade-off of between reproduction and survival. That is, unless you become specialized, unless you have specialized cells. And because what happens is the basal bodies have to leave the base of the flagella, go take up their position in the mitotic spindles, and the flagella can continue to beat for about the equivalent of five cell divisions. So once you get above 32 cells, you end up with, if you don't have division of labor, that the colony is non-motile for a period of time. And so that's why you end up getting these specialized cells. So what Matt did is he selected on body size. Our reason was that, okay, can we get, if we select for bigger colonies, are we going to get more specialization, getting closer to Volvox, like you were asking? And so we did that, and he did that in two environments, one in a still environment where the beakers are not being shaken, and in a mixed environment where you would think that swimming wouldn't really matter. So having a flagella would be more, the reasoning was that having a flagella would be more neutral in a mixed environment that's constantly being mixed versus a still environment. And this is the number of somatic cells. And what you've seen in the mixed experiment, there's a shift basically in the still environment from what it is in the mixed environment. So this is a kind of thing that we think we can artificially, you know, take a step towards Volvox by working with these intermediate species that have plastic number of somatic cells.
So the fact that being motile is using the same, is it the same field or something? It's using the same thing as the spindle.
The basal bodies, yeah.
The arrows, right?
Yeah, I mean of having that limited.
It seems to be a peculiarity of this group of organisms that being motile is inconsistent with doing it.
Yeah, it's a fundamental trade-off. Like the other algae don't have that. Yeah.
So was that kind of something about?
What about other single? What about just any other single cell eukaryotes? Is this really unique to this, or are there other examples of the same?
Well, I should know, but I don't. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The flagellum generally does need to be absorbed. I mean, even in your cells, you've got primary cilia that get absorbed before the cell leaves.
I don't know the details either, but I don't think that's unique to this particular, these particular groups.
So let me just finish with, in the last 10 minutes, I'll talk about this project that we started last time we were at KITP with these computer scientists, or that Pierre Turin did. And it has to do with predicting protein-protein interaction networks. And again, I know less about this than I know about the molecular biology of cyclins and so on. But since the work was began here, I thought I would just end with that. So the idea was to get some view of how the protein interactions change during these evolutionary transitions in these multicellular lineage of these algae. And so our approach was, Frank Dean was here. I don't know if any of you remember him, but and Pierre Durand, was to take the genomes of clammy, gonium, and volvox, and using this prediction engine, which I don't know much about at all, and I'm hoping some of you know about these ways of predicting protein-protein interactions. I know there's problems with it, but using this engine called, it's a massively parallel protein interaction prediction engine. Is this something that cell biologists know about, or is it common or not? I mean, maybe
it's... I don't know it, she's the one to ask.
Yeah, I don't know this.
Yeah. Well, I don't either, but this group of people use it then, and you can see Frank started doing some work on it. His talk was online here at KITP. And then using these protein interaction networks that are predicted by the genomes of these three species, one can look at the number of modules that fall out and the interaction between the modules using this bioinformatics tool, which is another thing that I know very little about. But it's fun to have all these things here. So we're looking at these three species, and we're asking what should be the protein interaction networks look like as you change from a unicellular individual through something like gonium that's not really a true individual yet. It's not indivisible, in other words. If you stress gonium, the cells start leaving the group and existing as normal cells. So it's not committed to group living, although it does exist as a group. It's not committed to it versus something like volvox, which is a clear multicellular individual. And so in this slide, you see the number of modules that are predicted for these three species, and then some unicellular outgroups here, Corella and Coccomyxa. In terms of the number of modules, so the number of modules increases in general as you go from unicellular up to volvox.
How are these modules defined?
Yeah, so it's this prediction algorithm that they go through this, it's this, yeah, we have to go back to that. Yeah, we have to go, go to this. It's called this order statistics local optimization method, and I don't know much about it. Yeah. But so the interesting thing, though, to me is that you end up with an increasing number of modules that are less connected. So the number of modules is increasing, and the modules themselves are more complex. Like there's more interactions within each module, but there's less interaction between modules. at least that's what's predicted by this analysis. So, and so I started wondering about that, and it seems like this makes sense when you think of cells as individuals versus parts of other individuals. In other words, when a cell is an individual, as it is in Chlamydomonas, its modules can be highly interconnected and integrated. But when it exists as a part of a higher level unit, then it has to its modules has to be less interacted and more free to serve the purposes of the higher level unit. And
this is a toxin that isn't that of the cellular species.
Say it again?
It's the purple guy up there, that's
yeah.
And chlorella is unicellular.
Uh-huh. Right.
Are you saying those are unicellular? Chlorella and toxin are unicellular species. So the red and the blue are the only multicellular ones up there, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
These are modules in the intracellular protein networks, right?
That's right.
So how does that link to the intercellular interaction?
Well, I don't know. I'm just trying to find a way of thinking about it. I mean, the intercellular, yeah, I mean, that's the challenge, is to have some framework to think about that.
So the number of proteins here per model, why it's so small? And why it's not
interchangeable? Well, I think it's a standardized number.
I don't have any way to judge the significance of these differences. So these are statistically different from each other?
Well, that's another problem, yeah.
Trying to estimate protein-protein
interactions
is quite a difficult thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess maybe you
could
call it an art.
I mean, does anyone believe it when people do this kind of thing? Would predict them from the genome?
Would it be better?
I don't.
You focus on.
I'll be straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
It depends how you.
Yeah.
You focus on like the fusion protein or apoptosis protein.
I mean, it helps if you have a database.
Well, it's a rabidopsis. That's what the database
is. Interesting to see where a rabidopsis
mm-hmm.
fits in. But it matters what they were trained on. I mean, it might have been trained on the rabidopsis.
Well, they were trained on rabidopsis, yeah.
You could look at that, right? I think it's, mm-hmm. you could look at the rabidopsis networks and then decide whether it actually was making sense in some biological way, and then check it in your organs.
Yeah.
It just seems like these numbers are.
Yeah, I don't know how to interpret them in that. Is there, is it a big difference in A or not? If there's another set of data that we've compared to.
Yeah.
My intuition doesn't. Yeah. Is it doubling a lot or a little? I don't know.
Yeah.
Or that maybe you would get more meaningful numbers if you looked at specific types of pathways or types of structures or something like that. This must be like everything, right?
So I think I'm pretty much done. Let me just go to my conclusion slides, see if we've even covered the basis of these things. So somehow fitness has to be reorganized as a cell becomes part of a higher level unit during these transitions and individuality that form the basis of the hierarchy of life. And by that I mean there has to be a transfer of fitness, not that fitness is a conserved quantity, but it has to be transferred to the higher level. And there's two ways in which, the basic way in which this occurs is that the lower level units specialize in the components of the higher level units. So that's why germ soma division of labor is kind of key to the evolution of individuality. Because once you have cells that are specialized in one component of fitness or the other, then they no longer, if they leave the group, they no longer possess all the components of fitness. And so they need to reside in the group. And this is the key to their commitment to group living. And as a result of that, then the heritability of fitness can emerge at the higher level. So that's one of the, so how does a group become an individual? I said this was the basic question that motivated my work. So the how of it, I think, has to do with these life history genes that exist in unicells, which are, a unicell is already faced with certain environments in which it has to downregulate reproduction and in favor of just maintenance and surviving. And so, and those genes that involve that, we call life history genes, because they're turning on one component of fitness or the other in certain environments. These genes can be co-opted to create somatic division of labor in the group, and we have evidence for that in these algae. And furthermore, then the cell cycle has to evolve in the group context. Once cells are in the group, then they're no longer optimized, then their cell cycle may no longer be, and their cell cycle starts changing in the group context, then they're no longer optimal when they leave the group, possibly. And so these are some of the mechanisms of how this can occur. The why, let me just get them all up here. The why has to do with these, and I did not get to this, with the trade-off between these two components of fitness becoming increasingly acute as body size increases. So that's why we were selecting on body size in that example that I gave you. Because the trade-off gets more and more convex, and that leads to specialization. And again, I didn't get to those points. But the general point is that kinship is not sufficient to understand the evolution of somatic division of labor, because it only exists in the larger species, and kinship should be more clonal in the smaller species, because the number of cell divisions is less. And so, so we can kind of understand, I think, these large jumps in levels of complexity in a Darwinian framework without positing kind of any other set of principles. And that, I think, is the value of this work in the Volusian algae. Thank you.
About this division of labor. So imagine you've got to the same place where you've got a column member that are all the same. And you're thinking about how my division of labor would be. It doesn't seem obvious to me that if you're going to form two cells, that one of them has to be non-reproductive. So I'm wondering if there's some other group of organisms somewhere where you have two different kinds of cells that do two jobs, but both of them are able to reproduce.
Yeah, you do get that in fungi, and but they're actually at this last workshop at KATP. If you map division of labor and ask, let's see, I'm trying to reconstruct this, but and ask, so there is evidence that. If you get germ soma division of labor, you get further division of labors. In other words, that settling the issue of who gets to reproduce is really a key step to get more complex division of labor. You do get two cell types in, and I'm forgetting what groups, but that are not, it's not a reproductive division of labor. You do get that, but it's rare, and you never find that with other, you know, you never had to find three or four cell types without at least having a reproductive specialized cell type. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it seems, that's why what you said about the losing the flagella seemed to be important, because if there's a fundamental constraint that says you can't swim and reproduce at the same time, then you're stuck with that division of labor being to do with reproduction. And you can get that almost for free, if you like. You don't have to ask why.
That's right. You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a result of this trade-off that drives that aspect of the colony form. But I would argue that there's always a trade-off between reproduction. I mean, I think in this case there is something very specific that drives the trade-off fundamentally. But in general, there's always going to be some kind of trade-off between reproduction and viability, I think. You know, so whether it's just energy or resources put into one activity or the other, they're rarely going to be mutually reinforcing, I think. Would you agree? Or I mean, it's thought to be the most basic trade-off in biology, I mean, in evolution anyway, that trade-off.
How many of these some cells are autonomous? I mean, we can see things in two different ways, right? Right. People like to say they give up the reproduction, so it's altruistic behavior. But okay, we can also go to the 19th century American South and say, oh, these Negroes just give up their freedom. And how do we know it's not just a form of slavery that this so-called germ cells actually give out some signalings and then reinforce this cell become soma line.
And, well, I mean, that's the basic idea behind policing. And, you know, I mean, so I think there is policing that goes on. I think policing is a kind of mediator of conflict I don't see how that changes kind of the flow of the logic. I mean, just if the altruism, there's no free will here in these cells. I mean, the altruism just emerges out of this simple trade-off, really. And so, I have a slide that I jumped over exactly about that point, but let me try to get to it here.
This is where it might have been nice to have the part you skipped over about the levels of fitness and the population genetics would kind of make that.
Yeah, I should have. Struggled more with the flow, getting a flow here, but
just keep talking about the separate couple. I'm just gonna get a cup of coffee and then come back.
You said something right at the beginning about this was not on the pathway that led to plants, is that what you said?
Yeah.
This was a different, there was a different pathway of specialization.
Yeah. I mean, if we just have two functions. So, at the lower level, you know, you have this basic trade-off between reproduction and motility, right? And so if you put this in a group, if you put this trade-off in a group context, and for some reason cells keep their flagella longer than other cells, well then they're behaving cooperatively or altruistically with regard to the ones that lose their flagella early, because they're at a disadvantage in a group by keeping the flagella and not using the microtubules in the in the mitosis, they're losing out within, in the group. And so, so.
Before we take the existence, before we take the presence of someone else as granted, we actually need to, I think, we need to first ask question, what's the process to drive them from a non-someone-self state to the someone-self state, right? And I guess my question is that drive an autonomous one, that you just simply, a self-organizing process, you just simply have some probability that some cell will fall into that state in your cellular regulatory network landscape, or it always needs to be pushed by other cells? I mean, it's fine after the existence.
I think that's an artificial, I think you're setting up an artificial trade-off because
these cells. I'm doing the opposite. I want to ask from the beginning, what's a molecular process driving it to some that state instead of asking first, what's the benefit of a so-and-so?
Well, what if the molecular process is just not allowing cells to grow? Yeah, I mean, so that's what I'm claiming here, that the process is this RegA gene binds to its transcription fighter, it binds to these regulators of chloroplasts, and the chloroplasts don't develop, and hence the cell can't grow. So then, I don't know if that's molecular, but it's a cellular process. It's a molecular cellular process, right?
I think that the thing here is the population genetics. I mean, these, if you look at it from the point of, point A, it forms this organism, and then point B, it's got a certain amount of offspring. Mm-hmm. You know, the soma cells are still just as committed as the reproductive cells, essentially, to the getting to the number of offspring they get to at the other end. So if you've got this mutation that says, I might arbitrarily turn into something with flagella that doesn't actually physically reproduce, it hardly matters because these are all clones, right? I mean, so
why don't you get soma in uterino?
What's that?
Why don't we
get
soma?
Well, I think that's a better question, yeah. I mean, my question actually would be more like that. Well, why isn't this easier to do, mm-hmm. given that? Because I don't think there's such a big trade-off. If there's this cohesion that they can be guaranteed that they're, it's bringing it into a group. These are very, very close relatives that are reproducing. Mm-hmm. And as long as it has that cohesion, you do get to a why not? If it can do.
There has to be a benefit turning the growth of the other ones up.
Yeah, the benefit is the survival.
And the has to make up the cost. There's a huge cost, right? If you're just two cells and one of you is not going to reproduce anymore, that's like a huge cost in fitness.
Well, the one that's not reproducing, if it's, they still have chloroplast, right? So are they still cranking away and feeding the other guys, or?
Well, they're
still green. I guess they must be still photosynthesizing.
Yeah, enough to drive their flagella. They're just not growing.
It's just enough to drive the flagella.
Yeah, that's the idea, yeah. I'm not sure we have any independent evidence of that, but that's the idea. Yeah.
But you see that the cost is huge. The benefit is huge, right? Because if you turn off that gene, you have the simple mutation that turns off the gene, and now you've got them all reproducing, right? Except what happens? They fall to the bottom and they die.
Right.
Right. So the cost of not having this differentiation is huge. It's infinite.
But the cost of not having it.
If they all reproduce, they all die.
I mean, it wouldn't be big enough.
No, but not big. That's not true. Only in the big species is that true. That scales with body size. In other words, in small species, they can beat their flagella for up to 5 cell divisions, even without the basal bodies attached.
So what would be the benefit of not having this flagella? I still don't understand. What would be the benefit for the whole group? Would it survive better?
If what?
Of the whole group, what would be the benefit losing this flagella and making the group of
It has to do with this trade-off, which is driving all this, that that they can't, they only have a limited number of basal bodies.
A limited number?
Basal bodies. These kind of motors that, drive the flagella or drive cell division. I have a kind of a crude picture of them, but. So it's that constraint that's really forcing this trade-off. And the benefit, so you were asking what the benefit is of.
The organism as a multi, like kind of multicellular organism for this particular algae compared to the single cell.
Oh, you mean why?
Well, the adaptive benefit, yeah.
Of being multicellular.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
For this case.
Right. So in this group, predation has a lot to do with it. You know, predators can't eat big things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The rotifers and so on that are feeding on these things. But of course, that can never explain the origin of multicellularity. Because if you're the first multicellular thing, well, then there's no predators. But
then there's no what?
Well, there's no predators. There's nothing bigger than you, really. I mean, there's not.
There might be a giant amoeba.
Well, there might be a giant amoeba, yeah. But I mean, I'm just saying.
Although I'm willing to believe there are different situations in which, I mean, as long as the selection pressure is there.
Well, yeah, there's lots of other benefits of being in a group. I mean, just there's a kind of homeostasis that can exist in the group. Groups, but body size, but I think predation is one of the important factor in this lineage.
Shouldn't there be like kind of a feedback that the cell know that they are in the multicellular organism, like extracellular matrix protein somehow, like the production of this protein should actually like a signal that they are in the multicellular organism. There should be some feedback mechanism of signaling, no?
Of what context?
Yeah, in the context that how would they know that, well, again, this is goes down to the process how this transcription factor gene is actually activated, so it can suppress chloroplast biogenesis. Yeah. So it should be feedback. They should know that they are in the extracellular matrix. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Mm-hmm. So production of this should be.
Yeah, and what is that you're asking? What?
Well,
what?
Asking if is it known? So, what production of ECM proteins should somehow be coupled to this signaling mechanism of activating of this transcription factor? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing that I know about that is that I think it's cell size. If the cell is small, then for some reason this RegA gene is expressed. And if you can artificially make a big cell, then it's not, no longer expressed. So there is this asymmetric cell division at the fifth. So if this is the cell lineage leading to a 4,000-cell Volvox colony, there's this asymmetric division that produces big cells and small cells, and these big cells do not express the RegA protein, and in all the small cells.
The extracellular matrix is formed already at the level of 32 cells, or not?
The extracellular matrix. Okay, that's what you're. No, no. These are. It's produced by the somatic cells. The extracellular matrix. So you're asking where the extracellular matrix comes.
It should be, yeah, a kind of mm-hmm. feedback there. So mm-hmm. how do they know that they are actually in there are other cells around them?
What else is interesting? I mean, you brought up the thing about organisms, a trade, you know, a twofold trade-off, but actually this is many more than twofold trade-off, right? And it strikes me that usually we have it that way, that there's a very few reproductive cells in most organisms. So, I mean, there's almost, once you go along this path, there seems like there's almost no cost to all the extra cells that aren't going to reproduce. You know, so I mean, you could argue logically that there is a...
The 98% of cells that don't reproduce.
Well, yeah, but you could argue logically that there's a really big trade-off that's occurring, but somehow it seems that in fact there's maybe not a really big trade-off, because the question is the packet of these reproductive cells, and then in the context of the organism, they sort of, I mean, we keep ourselves a lot. I mean, you know, you can't argue, you're not going to argue that for yourself, right? You know, what's the use of that brain of yours, Paul? Because, you know, why don't you devote all your energy to your gonads, right? I mean, even in the context of most multicellular organisms, I think there's not really a one-to-one trade-off, you know, a proportional trade-off like that.
Yeah, but I think that changes with body size. I think if you go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8, I think having cells specialized and not having cells not reproducing is costly. But maybe when you're up at 2,000, adding, when you're up at this level, probably less costly.
I mean, is there anything where, are there examples of things where, you know, 32 cells and only one of them doesn't reproduce? Because, I mean, the trade-off argument would kind of go in that direction. You know, you have one cell that has a flagella and the rest reproduce, you know.
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't be much trade-off.
Yeah, so you're kind of asking a question, what is the fewest number of somatic cells we ever see in a colony? Yeah, I think that's kind of the question you're asking. And so, it's having one somatic cell. Is that, presumably that's not... I mean, it all depends on the size of the colony. So the smallest number we see are in those species where we did those selection experiments. And
it does make one wonder if something's wrong with that logic.
Why does it?
So I think in cyanobacteria you get this cell specialization where some of them are big cells and they do nitrogen fixation or something, and the rest of them don't do that. And it's those like 1 in 10. And I remember seeing these pictures where it's like 1 in 10 big cells that doesn't reproduce.
Yeah, so that would be an example of that.
Right.
So here you might have 16 somatic cells, you know, and so in the selection experiments, you know, we were looking at, you know, these are some of the numbers. You would get down to maybe 12 in this organism, but you never get down to like 2 or something. Except there is another species that you do see that. there is a species actually where you see 2 or 3 somatic cells. And we just don't have a framework for understanding that at all, actually. And because it's hard to imagine the benefit of just two cells in a 32 cell colony can't move that colony.
How do they stick to each other if there are two cells? Is there no ECM or anything? How do they stick to each other? How do they know that they should be close to each other all the time? So
you're talking about in a colony that's only two cells.
Well, in the colony you have ECM, kind of which holds them together. But then for two cells, what would be for the benefit, and how would they?
So there are these cytoplasmic bridges, basically.
You mean because of this just cytoplasmic bridges?
Yeah.
They would just stick in.
Yeah, there's no colony boundary.
Yeah.
Even up to 8 or 16 cells, there's actually no colony boundary. Here, there's a colony boundary. And the key thing, which I should have gotten to, but
he's got that shared ECM that he didn't go into as much. But you were saying at the beginning that was very important.
So, so basic clamas, they're actually stuck here to a remnant of the mother cell wall here. They're kind of stuck. So this is a four-celled organism. So in Chlamydomonas, this component of this, there's a tripartite cell wall. There's three components to the cell wall here. And this intermediate component is what expands into the extracellular matrix. And the outer component becomes the colony boundary. So this is Volvox.
So that integrity, in a way, seems like that's the integrity of the organism, which has to be key. But I mean, if these were cells that were spontaneously associating them to organisms,
right? They're not
probably. But you would expect that would be very hard to do a very different behavior, because then the cell, the individual cell's got no reason to value the reproductive success of its neighbors relative to itself. But if they're all, they're the product of this, they're four cells that are related by two cell divisions, right? Then it's got a reason to care. In a genetic sense, of course. And so that EC, I think that's interesting that you're saying the ECM seem to be key, and that ECM seems, in a way, that's what's creating its integrity as an organism.
So at what point of cell division does ECM occurs, actually? I still didn't understand.
You mean the production of it?
So from the single cell, start dividing, and then at some point, the whole structure is formed.
I don't know, but I'm writing this down.
Yeah, there must have been a step where it stopped. I mean, there must have been a step where it started dividing without dividing the ECM.
The ECM is like
single cell. There is no ECM, so.
Well, the Chlamydomonas is the single cell up top, which has double wall between the double wall structure. If I understand this right, the Chlamydomonas would have just divided and it would form things like itself, right? But at some point, it stopped dividing the outer structure and started just dividing the inner structure, right, to get to the Volvox.
No, she's right. At some point, the ECM is, in other words, you just have cell division. You're not making ECM yet. In other words, so
I thought you said that.
So in this period here, So you can see in these juveniles, there's not a lot of ECM. There's less. The somatic cells are closer together. There is some ECM in these babies, but they do have a kind of growth that doesn't have to do with cell division. It has to do with ECM production after they leave the mother. There's some of that happens. ECM production happens inside the mother, and some of it happens outside the mother. There's no more cell division, but it's all ECM production. Yeah.
What are those babies inside babies?
No, you don't.
Well, what are the little dot babies?
Well, these are single cells. These are germ cells.
What's holding it all together? I mean, there's the liquid stuff inside that you're calling ECM, but there's an outer wall.
Yeah, there's a colony boundary.
Yeah, what's the boundary?
I mean, what are the proteins that make it up? And
so it's a protein, some sort of protein boundary.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's known. I don't have the words right now. But yeah, I know.
But people know the genes which encode these proteins. Did you study them? I mean, ECM proteins.
We Well, I mean, in the genomics, you see.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they've diversified. Gonium does not have those genes, but Volvox does. There's been a huge diversification of these genes. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm still, I don't know what I want to understand this, but I mean, I thought you said, so in Pteromonas, I thought you said it had an inner cell membrane. And it had an outer cell wall.
And something in between.
And it had a space in between. And I understood you to say that.
I did say that, yeah.
That's what the cell, that's what evolved into the ECM.
Right, the stuff in between.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, so that's what I was talking about when I was saying, at some point it was a single cell with this outer wall.
I'm talking about like kind of embryogenesis, how they, when they divide, like Volvox, just Volvox, when it divides like into two cells and then like four, there is nothing, no, they do not extract proteins which form a ECM, as far as I understand, at some point they start.
Well, okay, well, this I think we're talking about the same thing. Can I just point to the picture?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See if I get it. All I'm trying to say is this guy's single cell, right?
Yep.
And this thing that's gray is going to turn into this stuff that's gray.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
But this is different organisms.
Yeah.
This is like in the monadas and the Volvox. So it will never.
That.
Yeah.
So evolutionarily.
Oh, evolutionary.
So,
yes.
So there's a relationship. Evolutionary,
yes,
relationship
there is.
Between,
I agree.
Those two.
Yeah.
So I'm saying at some point, this thing was when every time it divided this outer wall,
mm-hmm.
right, and this matrix in half. Say whatever between the two new daughters.
I don't know. In Volvox, is it the case or not?
I'm just saying.
Yeah,
at
yeah.
some point, it was doing that, and then here,
yeah.
it's not dividing that outer wall anymore. It's sharing them. That's all I'm saying is that there's sort of an evolutionary difference where it had to say, I'm just going to divide the inner thing. I mean, if this starts dividing the inner thing. Instead of the outer thing, it kind of turns into that.
It is true, but like the question is, in Volvox, these cells, which are cells which would then give rise to another organism, do they have a spore as well, as like chlamydia monadus?
A spore?
Yeah, does it have this, whatever, wall? Because we are talking about evolutionary, yes, it gives rise probably ECM, it is, but not evolutionary, but like the whole.
My understanding is this is homologous to that, the black, I mean the
homologous, yeah, but like in Volvox, when you see these spores inside this colony,
uh-huh.
they give rise to another colony.
That's right.
Do they have the spores also, yeah?
No, they don't have this outer cell wall.
They don't, okay, so it's.
Where do the babies come from?
Well, it's just this large germ cell produces the babies.
Yeah. So they start multiplying, and then at some point
they just grow.
Yeah.
Well, so does it? I mean, the babies at one point are one cell, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then
it's called the germ. Yeah.
So as the babies developed into this structure with germ cells and outer soma cells, when do they form a structure going in Volvox going from a mass or a pair of cells into that division of structure?
Say your question again.
So there's the Volvox. Yeah. So those G's.
Yeah.
At that point, they're kind of a cluster of cells already?
No, this
That's
is just one
cell.
That's a single cell, yeah.
Okay, so what happens to the point from the single cell structure going to the that Volvox structure with single germ cells inside of it and the division, do you see what I mean? When does it go to 8 cells, 16 cells?
Yeah, it grows really big and then it divides a lot. And then it goes under an inversion, actually. There's kind of a gastrulation.
At what point ECM is formed?
Yeah.
This is not.
I know you're.
Yeah.
I don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah. Okay.
I know it's formed while it's in the mother and it's formed after the mother, but I really need to dig in on that one. Yeah.
I have, of course, maybe we can discuss it later. I have a question. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, your talk was very interesting. Of course, for protein-protein interactions, we can discuss it later because we did a lot of things on basically on studying that. But I have a question about actually the transcription factor mutation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you? If you have 5 minutes, so we can do it later if you want.
No, I have 5 minutes.
Can you please go back to your slide on this, what I understand, the mutation of this in this transcription factor, it led to this basically visions of the somatic cells, yeah? And I guess they divide like what, as forever? Or
let's see, which slide did you want to have?
About the story about this transcription factor, REG A.
I think, let's see, was it this one?
It was before, yes. So you said what you said, so like in one species which you study, or you said in several species, one mutation in this gene.
Yeah.
It's basically makes.
Gives you this.
Gives you this, and they like, but still they at some point start to multiply, yeah? Or they can just multiply forever the cells.
No, they, at this point, so these little cells de-differentiate and produce this mass here, but,
Which continues, because if you now can make as many chloroplasts as possible, so it seems like there are no constraints, so the somatic cells can just divide forever, unless there is some other regulatory mechanism. But they stop at some point dividing or not. They form still structure, they, I guess.
You mean,
but
before the mutation?
No, after the mutation, they become whatever, they start dividing, but still they are constrained by the whatever,
sure.
CM or something,
yeah?
Yeah,
yeah.
But just many of them in this,
right. Yeah.
I see. So, and my question was, since you sequenced several species, first question was, but I guess you said it's, we don't know that, for those species where you know this mechanism takes place, where only one mutation in one gene can lead to this colony growth,
right?
How different these genes are from each other?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to pinpoint, is there a variation, a mutation? What, it's like single mutation which basically leads to this very, because I am just parallel with cancer, kind of see it. Here, so it would be interesting to see. Did you try to see if this transcription factor has, did you try like to analyze it, this gene and protein?
What was the word, internal?
Did you try to analyze this transcription factor? Like amino acid sequence or what?
I mean, it's been cloned. Mm-hmm. The gene has been cloned. The transcription factor itself, no.
No,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so.
All right.
Uh-huh.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, so it was, thank you.
Yeah.
Really cool.